we want to focus on the solution. We want to focus on the 99% opportunity we have to solve this going forward. And we are.
Governor Walker hires a mediator to help solve the budget impasse. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, June 1st. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the North Pacific Fishery Management Council considers major new limits on wasted halibut.
What happens in the Bering Sea doesn't stay in the Bering Sea. What happens in the Bering Sea happens to all of us.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Governor Bill Walker has hired a mediator to help lawmakers reach a deal on the budget. Walker made the announcement at an Anchorage news conference this afternoon. He also said state agencies began sending layoff notices to 10,000 workers who could lose their jobs if the legislature doesn't pass a budget by July 1st when the new fiscal year begins. Walker says lawmakers are arguing over a relatively small piece of the budget.
The amount of difference right now being argued in the legislature is really approximately 1% of the problem. You know, we have a $3.5-4 billion deficit, and that we're staring this year and next year as well. If you combine the years, it's even half of that. We want to focus on the solution. We want to focus on the 99% opportunity we have to solve this going forward, and we are.
The Senate Finance Committee yesterday rejected a compromise between the House majority and minority. The governor says he can't force the various parties to try mediation to resolve their differences, but he thinks it could help. He retained the services of Anchorage lawyer and mediator Matt Peterson. Peterson says he got a call from Walker early this morning. He says he usually mediates complex litigation involving business disputes, and he thinks the situation in the legislature isn't so different.
And in my experience, if you can get everyone talking, identify the areas that are agreed upon, which appears to be a huge percentage of what we're dealing with here, and then focus on fair and reasonable negotiations of the remaining part, I as I sit here right now, I'm actually very optimistic that this could be mediated.
Peterson says he's cleared his schedule for the rest of the week. Meanwhile, a spokesman for the Democratic-led House minority says negotiations were occurring between the House minority leader and Senate president this afternoon. Christopher Clark is a former reporter and legislative aide who has been watching the action unfold. He identifies one of the biggest sticking points.
In a nutshell, it's the cost of living pay raises. The House sent over a compromise that had approved those cost of living raises, but it also had a staggering $30 million budget cut. In other words, forcing the governor to pay for those somewhere from savings in the budget. And the Senate is still saying, no, that's still too much. It doesn't make sense to give cost of living pay raises at a time when we're facing multi-billion dollar budget deficits. And it doesn't make sense to add that to the base of a budget when calculating the next year's budget. So that really is the center focus now. Also, of course, is education funding. As you know, the Senate reduced the base student allocation education funding by 4%. The House added that amount back in, $16.4 million. And I don't really know or sense that truly is a sticking point. It seems more the sticking point appears to be that and the $15 million of what Senator Kelly is calling pet programs that the minority asked to be added into the House package in order to comprise a compromise. And those are things for less money for the university, for ferries, for frontline social workers, even public broadcasting, things like that. So those are the sticking points at this moment.
Chris, the Democrats have been steadfast about the pay raises for state workers. Is the concern about contract litigation, or why, when people are just thinking about being able to keep their jobs, is there so much stress over raises?
It's about good faith bargaining. and sticking to your word. The counter to that, of course, is everything subject to appropriation. And that's where this could be a very sticky issue to resolve in court, that anything that the legislature does is subject to appropriation. But the counter argument to that is a deal is a deal. And if you can't be trusted on a union contract, why in the world should the oil producers trust us on a gas project contract? So it's very much about honoring your word. The union representatives themselves would prefer to have these cost of living pay raises ratified, even when it means that more people are going to be laid off. Because if you're going to force the administration to find $30 million of savings in order to pay for the cost of living pay raises, that means real people are going to lose real jobs. And so it shows you how important that is when the unions are picking that as an option.
Chris, Medicaid expansion isn't on the agenda for this special session, but did it come up today?
It came up today on the Senate floor. Senator Johnny Ellis offered the Medicaid expansion, spoke eloquently about it, and it was tabled just as it had been when it had appeared in the House. And the reasoning for the tabling motion wasn't given on the Senate floor, but the reason it has been given in the House side was that it wasn't germane because there's another bill still at play. In this case, it's in the House Finance Committee, House Bill 148. So in theory, it was not germane to the topic in front of the Senate today, which was House Bill 2001, a budget bill. Although, arguably, as Senator Ellis made, this is a budget item that could have been added to it. So it's very much wrapped into the politics over Medicaid expansion.
Christopher Clark is a former reporter and legislative aide. The Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation has announced the abrupt retirement of its chief executive officer, Mike Burns. Burns' immediate departure is due to unspecified health concerns, according to a short statement issued today. Chief Financial Officer Valerie Mertz has been named as acting CEO as the search gets underway for interim and permanent replacements. The corporation's Board of Trustees convened a special meeting by teleconference this morning to accept Burns' retirement. Board Chair Bill Moran said they appreciate the many years of service and outstanding performance that Burns brought to his role as CEO. According to state figures, Burns made $346,000 in salary in 2014. He also received $120,000 in additional compensation and benefits, such as health insurance and retirement. The Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation is a state-owned corporation responsible for managing the state's oil wealth savings account. It's different than the Permanent Fund Dividend Division, which is the state's division responsible for vetting applicants for the dividend and dispersing checks every October. The market value of the Alaska Permanent Fund is now nearly $54.5 billion. Primera Alaska is asking the state and federal government to approve an average rate increase of 39% for its Affordable Care Act health insurance plans in the state for 2016. That follows a 37% increase that was approved for 2015. The company says a small number of customers with complex medical problems are filing millions of dollars in claims that can't be absorbed by the small size of the insurance pool in Alaska. Primera has about 8,000 members on Affordable Care Act plans in the state. Primera spokesperson Eric Erling says the company is working with the state of Alaska to develop a reinsurance program that would help spread the risk of expensive claims.
That would help stabilize the market so that consumers are not potentially vulnerable to these sort of significant rate increase requests, whether it's from Primera or one of our competitors.
Moda Health, the other insurer who offers health plans on the federal exchange in Alaska, has filed for an average rate increase of about 22%. Many Alaskans who buy insurance on healthcare.gov qualify for subsidies that would help lessen the impact of any increase. The state will make its decision on whether to approve the rate increases by August 25th. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a job fair in Anchorage for marijuana-related employment.
Growers, trimmers, bud tenders, people are going to need accounting.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal Housing Lender, Member FDIC. Many Alaskans who die in boating accidents don't die of hypothermia. Without a life jacket, drowning kills long before hypothermia does. More at pledgetolive.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
A bill to reauthorize the Magnuson-Stevens Act, the nation's primary fishing law, passed the U.S. House this evening, largely on party lines. The sponsor, Alaska Congressman Don Young, says the bill makes practical revisions to continue a law that has restored the health of America's fisheries.
The opposition is coming from, you know, not the fishing community, is coming from, very frankly, the environmental community. And why they are opposing it, I don't really know, you know, other than the fact that they think that I'm weakening NEPA. I'm not. Endangered species, I'm not. This bill is originally, and it always should be, a sustainable yield fisheries bill for the fish and for the communities.
Much of the debate on the House floor did concern NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act. Democrats like Representative Debbie Dingell of Michigan says Young's bill would gut the public process required under NEPA.
Stakeholders, including businesses and individuals, would get less consideration in the council process and would not have a way of voicing their concerns and influencing the directions of plans or projects that could threaten the environment or the livelihoods of these people.
Young says the same environmental review required by NEPA would still take place, but it would be part of the council process to avoid duplication. Of the 30 million pounds of halibut caught last year by commercial fishermen statewide, nearly a third was thrown back into the ocean dead. They were netted accidentally by boats targeting other fish. Now that may change. The North Pacific Fishery Management Council, which oversees the federal waters off Alaska, is considering major new limits on wasted halibut or bycatch at its meeting in Sitka this week. As KCAW's Rachel Waldholtz reports, the decision will have impacts from southeast to the Bering Sea.
Critics argue that too many fish are dying in the nets of big Bering Sea trawlers, and that means less halibut for everyone else.
Halibut's one of the two most important species, along with salmon, to the coastal communities of Alaska. The bycatch threatens all of that.
That's Linda Benkin. She's the head of ALFA, the Alaska Longline Fishermen's Association, which represents mostly small boat commercial fishermen. She calls the Bering Sea Alaska's nursery ground for halibut. Studies have found that young fish migrate from there into the Gulf of Alaska and southeast. And that means...
What happens in the Bering Sea doesn't stay in the Bering Sea. What happens in the Bering Sea happens to all of us.
And what happens in the Bering Sea is this. Trawlers targeting flatfish like yellowfin sole drag their nets through the same deep water habitat where halibut live, and invariably catch some. The law requires trawlers to discard that halibut, but most fish don't make it back into the water alive. Last year alone, trawlers scooped up and discarded about 5 million pounds of halibut in the Bering Sea. This has been the case as long as there's been trawling, but the issue has become more urgent in recent years as halibut abundance has dropped. In the last 10 years, the exploitable biomass, that is, the population of fish big enough to catch, has declined by half, and halibut fishermen have seen their catch limits drop with it. But the caps on bycatch have remained essentially the same. So ALFA has asked the council to reduce the trawl bycatch cap by 50%.
Yeah, a 50% bycatch reduction would be absolutely devastating to the Amendment 80 sector.
Chris Woodley is head of the Groundfish Forum, which represents most of what's called the Amendment 80 fleet. That fleet is made up of six companies, most based in Seattle, with about 18 catcher processors targeting flatfish in the Bering Sea.
Essentially, our boats would be tying up 5 to 6 months early. And it would also have significant downstream impacts to the maritime economies of remote communities in Alaska, primarily on Alaska, Adak, Kodiak, and Sandpoint.
Woodley says the fleet has already made voluntary efforts to reduce bycatch, and they're asking the council to let them adopt other measures, like deck sorting, which would allow them to return more halibut to the water alive.
There may be some things, more things that we can do, but all of that comes at a cost, and we're concerned that people don't appreciate, you know, that we've already been making, you know, have already made significant improvements, and it's not so simple as just flipping a switch and everything gets better.
For Behnken, the big issue is what kind of fisheries Alaska wants. The commercial halibut fleet is made up of about 1,000 small boats, most of them family-owned.
I would say the way fisheries are changing, there's definitely, it's the way our country is changing. It's what farmers, small farmers have faced. It's the industrialization of the food system. To me, this decision the council's facing, it's really a landmark decision. They are deciding between a fishery that has a 100-year tradition being commercially exploited by small boats, community-based. This is a really important fishery to Alaska. And this fish being taken as bycatch, wasted in the industrial Seattle-based fleet.
But whether the council sees it that way is up in the air. The council is expected to vote on bycatch caps this weekend. In Sitka, I'm Rachel Waldholz.
The U.S. House today voted to sell a 9-acre lot in Anchorage to the municipality at fair market value. The property at 40th and Denali Street is one of the largest undeveloped lots in Midtown. The late Senator Ted Stevens intended the site to be the Alaska location of the National Archives. With his support, the government bought the land in 2004 from real estate developers John Rubini and Leonard Hyde for $3.5 million. But when Stevens lost his Senate seat, the project had no champion and was never constructed. Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan wanted the land as a transit hub. The transition manager for Ethan Berkowitz says the mayor-elect is still considering the best use for the land. The bill next moves to the Senate.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation providing oilfield services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. And by Raven Alaska, providing business travel needs in over 100 communities across the state. Find more at flyraven.com.
The state's first ever job fair for careers in commercial cannabis was held in Anchorage over the weekend. As KSKA's Zechariah Hughes reports, it offered a glimpse of how the semi-legal marijuana industry is taking tentative steps toward professionalism and profits.
Teresa Collins shuffles between prospective employers and job seekers inside the enormous, high-ceiling room that serves as the venue for the special events company she runs at 420 West 3rd Avenue. And yes, that is the actual address. Collins is working with the newly formed Alaska Cannabis Growers Association to match would-be workers with jobs that don't yet exist.
Growers, trimmers, bud tenders, people are going to need accounting, admin. There's going to be all kinds of different new jobs in this industry that people that already have the skill set from other industries can bring over into this industry.
Collins wants Alaska's new commercial pot sector to be legit, law-abiding, and mature, in part because it makes for good business. To that end, though the club has a distinct aroma of pot smoke no one is visibly consuming, Collins banished dues-paying club members who want to imbibe to the VIP section in the back. The rest of the venue is all business.
I don't think it really shows that you're very professional if you're going to smoke a joint before you sit down for an interview.
Collins was impressed with the turnout. More than 100 people stopped by and registered information for jobs. But one attendee, who asked that I just call her Morgan, was slumped over a table, filling out a form with questions like, what is your relationship with cannabis? And what experience do you have working with cannabis, and in what capacity? Morgan is here because she knows a lot about pot and thinks the business environment will likely be more laid back than regular retail or office work. She's a little disappointed by the event.
It's a little bit skinnier than I guess I thought it would be. I thought it would be a little bit more like a regular job fair with booths and employers, and it seems a little bit more like a cattle call.
Those forms could be dropped off with any of the three businesses present, including Alaska Cannabis Staffing. Owner Kyle Houghton is setting up a database of potential employees he hopes to sell to companies needing laborers.
I got to build a database first before I have any value to offer employers. But really, it's just getting started now. Most of the jobs are going to come next year.
Houghton's business model isn't new, a cross between a temp agency and a job site, but it depends on a robust industry that does not yet exist. Much like insurance brokers and equipment suppliers, Houghton's is an ancillary business that stands to profit from what many expect to be a green gold rush.
Which is why I chose this business model. I want to be involved without being involved. I don't want to be heavily regulated.
Back in the VIP lounge, I talk with a business owner who will be very involved, Justin of Green Dream Farms. We're in the smoking area because Justin, who asked that I not use his last name, is showing me one of the products he hopes to eventually sell, DAB, an essential oil extracted from a large quantity of cannabis. Concentrated products like DAB have been a bit of a boogeyman in conversations over how to regulate marijuana. But as Justin shows me a battery-powered pipe called an oil rig, he says that perception comes from misunderstanding.
I think it's a healthier, safer, faster product.
If you've never seen these operate before, it's almost an instant heat. So the minute I hit the button...
Justin's business doesn't officially exist. There's no storefront or commercial processing facility, and lawmakers have yet to finalize rules about permits or controversial products like concentrates. But while many variables are still unknown, Justin says recruiting early has some crucial benefits to his business strategy.
Two things. One, it's future branding. It's all future marketing and branding. We just kind of want to get our name out there. And the reason why the job fair, we want a team assembled before licensure a little bit so that when we are licensed, we can hit the ground running.
For Job Seeking Morgan, it was a good event for networking, but didn't yield many tangibles.
I think that there's a lot of work to be had. It's not just necessarily readily available yet.
The state still has about a year until it expects the first commercial marijuana operations to open for business. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Many of Alaska's seniors are in danger of losing their only means of paying for disability services. The state and federal government partner in funding in-home and assisted living services for the seniors who qualify. But individuals who met the state's criteria for years are now being let go from the system. KBBI's Quentin Chandler has more.
First, picture a nursing home. The whitewashed walls and shining tile floors, that scent of industrial-grade disinfectants. Main Street Assisted Living in Homer is the polar opposite of that. It's a house. In the center is a living room, and directly behind it, a full kitchen. Hallways to the left and right lead to bedrooms and a downstairs office. 75-year-old Lily Mann says she came to the center 7 or 8 years ago.
I was rescued by Adult Protective Services at the request of my doctor, who said that I was no longer safe to live at home. And now they want to throw me out. The state rescued me, and now they want to get rid of me, which is just mind-boggling.
Mann says before, she was falling and breaking things. She still has balance issues. She recently fell and hurt her foot. She also needs help with basic hygiene, things so personal she's embarrassed to discuss them.
I get help with bathing. I get help with taking care of my recurrent yeast infections, which I'm physically incapable of treating, of reaching and treating. I get help with working out with cleaning my CPAP machine. It's another situation where I can't stand up long enough. Well, you know, they do the usual stuff. They carry away all the wet diapers.
Now she might lose it all.
I was just told that I was denied.
When Lily says denied, she's talking about her Medicaid waiver. Presently, the state uses four types of waivers. The one we're interested in is labeled 1915C, or just the C option. Seniors who use the C option choose to live in their own home with a personal nurse or in an assisted living home, but they must be eligible for institutional level of care. Simply put, they have to be able to gain admittance into a nursing home, even though they are choosing not to live in one. Brian Richardson is CEO of Immediate Care, a company that provides assisted living services to clients across the state.
In 2013, there was a change in the Alaska state regulations, and what the industry believes is the interpretation of a certain two sentences in those regulations has led to people being declared ineligible for nursing home supports and therefore ineligible for these kind of home and community-based services.
Senior Disability Services, or SDS, Director Dwayne Mays disputes Richardson's claims. He says the department is controlling the Medicaid waiver program just as it was always meant to. But one key development gives the impression that more denials are being mailed than should be.
There were lawsuits from a long time ago, years ago, specific to our personal care attendant program and our Medicaid waiver program.
According to Mays, those lawsuits challenged SDS's methods for assessing individuals' eligibility for the program. The appeal process the department provided people who didn't agree with their assessment was also under scrutiny.
And so we resolved those lawsuits. So for literally a period of 7 to 8 years, we were unable to remove anybody that no longer met level of care from our waiver system.
Mays says it was about 3 years ago that those lawsuits were settled. That's around the same time Richardson says there was a jump in the number of people found ineligible.
I think that's probably the impact that people are feeling is now when we do our job and we determine if a person continues to meet eligibility for the waiver program, if there's a significant change for the better and they no longer meet eligibility, then there needs to be, we need to address other types of services for those individuals.
Waiver recipients go through an initial assessment when they first apply for the waiver, and they are reassessed annually. Caregivers and residents at Main Street Assisted Living think the assessments don't go far enough. They say they only focus on physical abilities, like can a resident feed themselves, can they turn over in bed, or go to the bathroom alone. Mays defends the assessment. He says it's the same process the department has always used, and the department's findings are reviewed by a third-party contractor. There's one more check on the process. People deemed ineligible are guaranteed an appeals process. Right now, Lily Mann is in the middle of appealing her denial. She's gotten help from an attorney with the Office of Public Advocacy. The owner of Main Street Assisted Living says 9 out of her 15 residents are at risk of losing their waiver.
They're going to be dumping a lot of people out. I can't go back to where I was living. I guess I'd just be competing with everybody else for a senior apartment or something like that.
Even if Mann finds a place, it's unclear how she'll pay for it, let alone get the care she needs. In Homer, I'm Quentin Chambler.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Rachel Waldholtz in Sitka, Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, and Quentin Chandler in Homer. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. Alaska Pacific University offers an affordable education, small class sizes, and life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. APU is still accepting applications for fall 2015. Find out about financial aid and the promised tuition grant and apply online at alaskapacific.edu before Saturday, August 1st. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.